Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment. We talk about science, policy, advocacy, and all the things that connect our personal well-being with the well-being of our communities, our society, and the ecological balance of our habitat, planet Earth. I cover all of these topics in Truth Out, Truthdig, Alternet, and a host of other online news outlets. Each week on the show, we welcome different authors, experts, scientists, thought leaders, filmmakers, poets, all kinds of folks to talk about the different facets that are impacting all of us in our interconnected world. And on today's show, I'm really thrilled to have with us a guest who's written a terrific book and provided an opportunity to kind of look at the bigger picture. The book is by our today's guest, Jeremy Lent. It's called The Patterning Instinct, and it's a cultural history of humanity's search for meaning, with a foreword by Fritjof Capra. You know, the thing about this book is that it really looks at the deeper questions that we discuss on the show all the time. It's not just the what of what we're doing in our world that is unsustainable in a whole variety of ways. It's the why, and the why has a lot to do with the cultural attitudes and beliefs that are prevalent in our society and are embedded in each one of us through our education, through our upbringing, through family, through friends, through groups, through participation in our society. And I really, really have long held and really am delighted by the premise of this book, which is that we need to kind of look more deeply into how we got here. What are the kind of innate underlying values and ideas that we share? And, you know, when we understand what they are, where they came from, why they're non-optimal in terms of addressing the challenges of this time, then, you know, we have an opportunity to become conscious about them, change them, and address some of our pervasive challenges. My guest today is Jeremy Lent. He is a writer and the founder and president of the nonprofit Liology Institute, dedicated to fostering a worldview that could enable humanity to thrive sustainably on the Earth. We'll be talking more about the Institute throughout the show. But basically, he is, in his book and at the Institute, integrating systemic science with ancient wisdom traditions. That's really a much-needed thing in a tall order. He formerly was the founder, CEO, and chairman of a publicly traded internet company, and holds a BA in literature from Cambridge University and an MBA from the University of Chicago. In other words, Jeremy Lent, our guest today, is someone who, you know, has taken his smarts to do something that enables him then to do good in a much-needed way in our world, and I really salute him for that. I just want to read one blurb from the book cover by a friend and heroine of mine, Atossa Soltani, the founder and president of Amazon Watch. She calls The Patterning Instinct a must-read for anyone concerned about the future of humanity. The book delves beneath the surface of problems facing our world today to examine the dominant cultural assumptions that lie at their root. Yeah, right. We really need that. Great. Looking forward to our conversation. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Jeremy Lent.
Well, thank you very much, Allison. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, first of all, you know, can you just give our listeners a brief intro of, you know, why we need to understand our worldview and thought patterns in order to get a handle on the tremendous challenges we have to deal with today in terms of climate, sustainability, and, you know, and how to live cooperatively in our shared world?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely, Allison. And I think the primary reason was something I discovered as I did the research for this book over a number of years. And we're used to thinking of basically the kind of forces that drive history as things like technological change or military power or and sort of things like this. And what I discovered is that at a deeper level, it's really values that drive history, that drive what people do. And those values are things that each of us inherits from our culture. And so understanding what our cultural assumptions are, essentially what the world view is that we all sort of take for granted, helps us to understand why we do what we do. And as we look back historically, it helps us to see how history was shaped in the past, and perhaps most importantly, how our current values will shape what we do with our future.
Yes. You know, because it's kind of the hardest thing there is to see is not just the physical universe. Obviously, that's vaster than our individual view can take in at any given time, but really the universe of beliefs and attitudes and assumptions that we just kind of breathe in and breathe out. And, you know, it's really hard to see beyond them because this, I mean, the very nature of it is this is what we hold to be true. And, you know, it's very, it can be unsettling to question beliefs, but, you know, can they actually, can our assumptions actually be more sort of flexible, or can they change? And you know, what are, like, for example, what's a current assumption that isn't sort of helping us that, you know, would be ripe for a change if we could manage that?
Yeah, so it turns out, if we look at the sort of real underlying assumptions our culture is based on, what I discovered that we can recognize kind of, if you will, root metaphors that we use to make sense of the world. Essentially, each culture, as it tries to make sense of the world, uses some kind of root metaphor, and everything sort of arises from that. So maybe like early agricultural societies had this root metaphor that the universe was filled with a hierarchy of the gods, and, you know, you needed to worship the one at the very top to get the best results, things like that. Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. In the modern world, our sort of root metaphor was really something that was founded with really like the scientific revolution in the 17th century, which is this notion, actually a couple of dual notions. One is to view nature as a machine, as something mm-hmm. that is there, that has no kind of intrinsic value of its own, but is there for us to understand and do with what we will for the benefit of humanity. And along with that comes a similar kind of metaphor, which is this almost like this rallying cry of conquering nature. And that was an idea that actually Francis Bacon was probably the first person in England in the 17th century to offer this amazing, like, sort of clarion call to scientists around his society. Like, look at what we can do if we can conquer nature, essentially, like, sort of torture the secrets out of her. And even though we don't talk about it so flagrantly nowadays in that way, that's basically, those two dual metaphors are basically what underlies the way that we think about humanity's relationship with the universe and with the natural world, and that's responsible at the deepest level for a lot of the imbalances and the mm-hmm. terrifying directions that we're taking society on now.
Yes, I could certainly see that. I mean, it, and you know, when it gets kind of instilled in us, like, I mean, I have also been in the healthcare field for many years, and you know, we know that part of the problem with healthcare in this epoch is that we are not acting proactively to do the things that are healthiest. Many people don't have the economic wherewithal or the access to healthy foods, but we're not acting proactively. Instead, you know, we're that negligent approach is resulting in the development of symptoms and hence disease eventually, and then we go out to try to attack and kill it. Overcome it. You know, it's a war, and a lot of the techniques actually come out of wartime emergency medicine, and they've just become normalized as our medical approach. And yet, even I, who am conscious of this and know about this, I'll, you know, have trouble not using those metaphors because this kind of worldview becomes so deeply ingrained. You know, our whole economy is based on, you know, sort of setting out to conquer different things in nature. You know, the whole fossil fuel industry, which is driving climate change, is about, you know, very much conquering new territories and getting new access to new things, regardless of, you know, who's laid waste in the process. I mean, all of what we're doing is really coming from, as you described, that kind of core idea. But, you know, how can that change when people's businesses, our infrastructures, people's personal identities, the medium of discourse between all of us is based on this?
Yes, you know, changing that is probably the biggest challenge that our world faces this century. And I do think we have to look at change at happening on multiple layers. You know, it's not enough, of course, to look at sort of changing these deep layers of thinking when every day we're faced with all kinds of actions that we see around us taking us on this unsustainable course and creating further exploitation. And we need to obviously be responding to those. We have to be organizing. We have to do things. We have to essentially fight for life and humanity every day. But at the same time, I guess where my book goes is that unless we also change those underlying structures of thought, we're just liable to change one sort of wrong-headed approach with another, that we have to also look at those deeper layers of ways in which we make sense of the world and look at what the possibilities are to see the world in a different kind of way, so that while we're fighting against the things that are going wrong right now, we can also work towards, really, I think, a real possibility of a more flourishing and more harmonious future. But I think we'll only get to that place if we do make some of these deeper shifts at a deeper layer in our consciousness. So I think there's this kind of two-tiered approach. And really, one of the hopes of my and for me writing this book is that it will help people to basically just be more conscious of, one, you know, what are the underlying assumptions that we use in our own worldview right now, and also by looking at other assumptions and ways in which other cultures have made sense of their world, and even the ways in which different modern rigorous scientific ways there are of making sense of the world, and how that can lead us to essentially consciously reframe our own sort of patterns of meaning, if you will, about how we live our lives.
So what other option? You're in effect saying that if we broaden our options rather than, you know, in our understanding that there are broader options than just the ones that we're most familiar with from where we are now in history and in this society, that, you know, that we could, you know, we could kind of, through becoming aware of these other things even, maybe begin the process of adopting them. You know, what would be some examples of that? You know, things that where we could hold it in a different way, and what would that way be?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, when we look at the underlying ways in which our modern worldview is leading to destructive behavior, what I see is a worldview that's based to a very large degree on a sense of separateness, of separation of things. So, you know, humans are basically seen as being like separate individuals, and we're all meant to be like sort of selfish individuals, and all by doing our own selfish thing, the world is meant to work in a better place. Humans are seen as being separate from nature, and each of us in our communities are seen as being separate from other communities. And I think that the alternative ways of thinking really start with a shifting to focus on connectivity. And actually, it turns out that really other worldviews, other than our modern European-originated worldview that's really become the sort of global mainstream worldview today, that other worldviews actually come from this notion of connectedness, seeing humans connected in community, and seeing ourselves as being more integrated within ourselves, and above all, seeing humans as being really part of nature, not separate from nature. So the thing is, we can get inspiration from other cultures from the past, but we can also get inspiration from a lot of modern findings in systems science, sciences like complexity theory, systems biology, and all kinds of sciences that are highly rigorous, but focusing on the connectivity between things. And that kind of allows us to find insights into a connected worldview that doesn't have to be one that rejects modern science, but instead actually embraces a real sense of what modern science is telling us about our connectivity.
Mm-hmm. What is science telling us? I think systems biology is one of the most interesting, you know, areas of science, and yet it is too little known. I mean, what are they finding there?
Yeah, you know, they're finding so many things that really kind of overturn some of the underlying mainstream views that science reductionist science kind of claims about the universe. So a lot of people nowadays are sort of faced, in my view, with what I think is a false choice. You know, they're told that either they can, if they want to, believe in some sense of transcendence in the universe, some sort of God up there in the heavens, or if they don't want to go there and they want to believe in what science tells us, then we have to accept the fact that there's this, that the universe is ultimately meaningless, that it's just a whole bunch of molecules hitting each other, and that's all there is to the whole universe. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a real shame that people feel that they're faced with that kind of choice, because what modern systems thinking is telling us is that actually we live in a universe where life itself is based on connectedness and is based on a sense of intrinsic meaning. So we see, for example, in systems biology and ecological science, that we see ecologies that arise, that emerge from all the different ways in which different species connect up with each other. And rather than all of them being out to do nothing but outcompete each other, there's actually an interesting balance between individual species competing and also working together and actually together creating their own niches where all can thrive in a more sustainable way. And, you know, I think we can learn a lot from what modern findings tell us about ecological ways in which species flourish together, to really come up with ways in which humans can begin to relate to the natural world in a more sustainable way.
Mm-hmm. What would an example of that be, for example?
Well, one way of recognizing how we can work together with nature is, rather than looking at this notion of, like, you know, we've got to conquer nature, it's just seeing that we exist within a complex system where human activity and natural activity needs to work together. So, you know, as an example, if we think of climate change and how we can respond to this really deep and existential problem facing civilization. You know, there's a rising group of people nowadays looking at the numbers and saying, well, since it's going to be so difficult for us to reduce our carbon emissions to the point that we need to prevent, you know, the worst excesses of climate change, we need to look at geoengineering as a solution too. And so they take this kind of notion of nature, once again, as this machine that we need to kind of fix, if you will, and start to come up with these really terrifying notions of, you know, putting billions and billions of little bits of tinfoil in the sky, for example, to reflect the sun's rays and things like that. And by not recognizing the deep, complex, and unpredictable ways in which humans interact with nature, and they're liable to actually just take a bad imbalance situation and make it even worse. But that's the kind of way in which, once we begin to look at humanity's relationship with nature as more the one where we are embedded in this complex system and it can't be predicted like a machine, we begin to see that we need to change our ways so we can be more in harmony with the natural world, rather than just trying to re-engineer it to our purposes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, the thing is, you can move one part, and we kind of have a reductionist rather than a systems form of science that we're operating from with a lot of these. And yet you move one small part and you don't know what all the repercussions are going to be of that. So, you know, they found that moving, you know, like this molecule or this chemical in the body does X, but they don't know all the other things necessarily that it does, or, you know, or what else it will trigger. So the fact is that we're actually doing these reductionist scientific experiments all the time on living systems. And, you know, I often think of a Chinese medicine where, you know, instead of giving like a single ingredient or something the way we do with a pharmaceutical patented drug, they'll give, you know, a formula that may have 15 or 20 ingredients, and what their expertise has been, you know, kind of refined over, you know, centuries and millennia and all, is figuring out how all of these interact with everything that's interacting within us. And yet we have this extremely sort of stripped down, simple-minded, you know, simple focal point. You know, I can just sell this one chemical by saying it does X, and then people go, well, that's science. But actually, the whole picture of science really is more complex, and it's just that our science hasn't, you know, hasn't regarded it as necessarily its task to look at that, you know, with the exception of the kind of systems science that, you know, is beginning to occur that you're talking about. Where does, you know, I mean, if you were thinking that we're not dealing with a living system, that we're dealing with a dead system, we're dealing with a machine, a robot could replace us, you know, all of these kinds of things, you know, then a lot of this kind of follows along, and it's not all good. You know, where does this whole process of mechanizing everything that's alive come from?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting that you mention Chinese medicine as an alternative to the modern sort of Western reductionist approach, because actually in my book, I look a lot at what traditional Chinese thought developed a very different way of looking at the universe. And so, you know, to answer the question you asked, where does that sort of mechanistic way of thinking come from? Again, we can see its roots its flourishing, I should say, really beginning in the 17th century with the scientific revolution. But actually, one of the things the book does, it looks way back to the very beginning of human thoughts, and looks at how these different ways of thinking developed in different ways. And actually, as far back as 2,500 years ago, we can see a divergence of thought between East Asian, traditional Chinese way of making sense of the universe, and the Western way. So actually, as early as the ancient Greeks and Plato, we see a kind of what I call a sort of a split universe, a conception of a split universe appearing, where, yeah, Plato did a fantastic job of putting different ideas together in his time and creating a really powerful vision of not just a split universe, but a split human being to go along with it. So he gave the world this idea that actually there was sort of two dimensions to the universe. There was this material world, which was polluted and things die, and it's really like the whole thing is just kind of not nice at all, like kind of gruesome and smelly. And there was this transcendent world of ideas. And really everything in the world was just a kind of a pale imitation of this idealized conception or forms, as he called them, of what things could be. So you have a concept of like good, and there was this ideal good, and then we could try to be as good as we can in the real world, but we don't get to that transcendent idea. And similarly, he viewed the human as being split, and that we had this horrible body that was kind of, again, smelly and polluted and would die. And the body was like a prison in which there was this eternal soul. And this eternal soul was what really connected us with deity, with divinity. And we were connected with that through reason. So this really sort of split way of looking at humanity and the universe was really bequeathed to Christianity, who took his idea and turned it into this kind of eternal soul, and his idea of transcendence and turned it into God and heaven. And then really when reductionist science came along in the 17th century, essentially what happened over several hundred years is that they kind of ultimately threw out this transcendent notion and just saw the world itself the way Plato and Christianity had always seen it, which is this material, desacralized resource, essentially, to exploit for humanity's good. But, you know, you talked about traditional Chinese medicine, and what I find so interesting is how just a completely different conception of the universe and humanity's relationship with it arose there. So it's no coincidence that traditional Chinese medicine looks at the human as a holistic system and the human relationship with her environment as a holistic system, because that's how China understood the whole world. And they understood as humans being embedded in the world. And the very source of meaning was not in some sort of transcendent place, but in the connections themselves. So they had this notion of the Tao. And the Tao was really the path, or the way, if you will, in which all different things harmonized with each other. You could almost envisage a sort of multidimensional web of meaning where every single thing connected with every other thing through a whole set of nodes within the network. So if you just touch one thing, you never know. Just like if you touch a web very gently, you can see it reverberate throughout the rest of the network. And the same is true of not just humanity, but the whole human relationship with nature. And I think that we can learn so much from applying that way of looking at the human relationship with nature in today's world. And what I find so exciting about all this is that this is not some sort of woo-woo rejection of science, but actually, as we were talking about earlier, systems sciences are looking at the world in the same kind of way, using rigorous mathematical models to do so.
Yes, I mean, you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, I've never really believed in the idea you create your own reality, because that just really, to me, is a will-based notion, you know, of how I could be happy or successful or try to cope with some stressful or distressing situation, that I don't make any attempt to alter in the outer world, but instead I try to manipulate my own mind about it. And to me, actually, that very concept, which is so prevalent nowadays, is actually treating oneself mechanistically.
Yeah,
in a certain sense. At the same time, it's really, you know, when you're embedded in one worldview, it will filter things in and out, and for the sake of safety, conformity with one's group, you know, kind of being in sync and not experiencing cognitive dissonance with one's colleagues, you know, or family or all of that, people will kind of adopt a limiting worldview and actually mistake that for the given reality, where the reality is actually this interconnection, and, you know, that you're describing, and you know, and that the Chinese view held. And, you know, the dilemma for us is that we've kind of been acculturated not to be able to perceive it, but that doesn't mean it isn't happening. So, you know, that it isn't like that. That isn't what's going on. And so the challenge then also becomes how do you kind of entrain with that and come to perceive and understand that? And, you know, I think understanding the history of how we kind of got into this more mechanistic model is really helpful. And then there's, you know, other ways where maybe we have value choice points that we're making, and we don't even know how to identify when we're going down the old same familiar road that's taking us nowhere versus taking a new path toward reflecting the kinds of values that you describe. Do you have any guidance on that for people, or any ideas about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think a place to begin is to look at what you were just saying about how some of these sort of individualistic kind of American tropes, if you will, formed from the sense of people who say, oh, you can create your own reality. And so, you know, what we need is positive thinking. And that's precisely the kind of thinking that's based on this view of humans as being like sort of individual elements. And, you know, we get to create our own reality by not recognizing how we're embedded in this complex system or within the world around us. And so in each case, I think the first place to go is to recognize that rather than try to reduce things to sort of individual elements, whether it's individual molecules in the universe or saying that, evolution and biology can be understood by just looking at the individual cell's gene, or saying that, as a society can be understood by looking at individuals all doing their own thing. That paradigm leads to this kind of exploitative and destructive way of being. And then looking instead at how do things connect up. So for me as an individual, or you or any listener as an individual, I think the first place to begin might be to recognize, well, I'm affected all the time by the different ways in which the universe is molding me, and recognizing that when we're just born as infants, and we use what I call our patterning instinct, this instinct that humans uniquely have to try to make sense of the world in some way. We use that to learn language. We also use it to imbibe our culture from whatever culture it is that we're brought up in. And that's where we begin to form deeply held assumptions that sometimes, we never even question. And then, when we're engaged in society, and it's not true to say that by will alone we can change our reality, because we're impacted by that all the time. So in this country, for example, if we happen to be in an ethnic minority, we can't just choose to be seen in a different way. People are acting and relating to us in a certain way, and we're going to react in certain ways to that. We can't just change that. So by looking at the interdependence of things, we can begin to recognize that all of us are having impact on each other at all times. And similarly, some people might look at all of, some of the terrible things that are going on both in society and the way that humanity are affecting the natural world. And maybe their lives are such that they can say, well, I'm not so impacted by it, and I choose, not to be politically engaged, and I'm just going to focus on my own life, and, I'll offer goodness to my family, and that's enough. And I think this sense of interdependence shows us that actually that is every much as political a decision to make as when you're consciously involved in politics. So to say, well, it's good enough for me and I don't need to do things to try to make the world a better place, is essentially to ignore the fact that your privilege arose from the exploitation of others in the current world and historically from generations of exploitation. And that as long as you just kind of accept that and go do your thing and claim to be not involved in the political process, you are absolutely involved in the political process. It's just your involvement is one of continuing the exploitation of those who have not been, maybe as fortunate or privileged in the life that they were born into as you. So I do think that this recognition of interdependence leads to just a clear awareness of the fact that all of us are engaged in this world at these different levels, in our human relations, in our political relations with each other, and in the ways in which we're impacting the future, the future flourishing of future generations.
Indeed. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And and of course, when, one's own life is good or whatever, the inclination to, stay in that bubble rather than listen to these disturbing potentials that are, murmuring and screaming from, what's going on in the body politic, is certainly present. One of the things that that we know, from scientific research, for example, is the fact that if one, if a person or a community resides in a lower economic area, they will have, you know, poorer health. They'll have, you know, all of their health measures will be lower all the way through. They'll have poor nutrition to start. They'll have poorer health care. They'll have more exposure to pollutants. They'll have, you know, earlier disease, disability, and death, you know. But it's been much harder, based upon the case of interdependence, to make the case to the privileged that they too are will be affected. And, you know, very often there's just a sense of, yes, we have these problems. Like, for example, if I'm an organic food consumer, you know, like I will choose organic if only everyone would. Well, you know, everyone maybe cannot afford to. Everyone will not have that option if we don't preserve the public policies that sustain that kind of food supply, if we don't make social choices to make it more widely available to all people. And so at the end of the day, then, you know, people are arguing and dividing further from each other over access to the health care and medical care that's required when we are inattentive toward democratizing some of the healthier choices and options. And yet it's, I have found through addressing as well as the environmental, I also address the health community, it's, you know, it's extremely, and the, you know, the environmental community gets what the source of pollutants are. The health community gets what the avoidance and treatment, you know, proactive treatment methods might be. But they're not united at all on a policy front, which has always really troubled me. And it's really hard to make the case that the, you know, rise in negative health impacts that, you know, from our industrial pollution and you know, fossil fuel use and other societal choices will also impact those who are in, you know, a more elite or privileged position and who therefore, you know, have their potentially more access to the levers of power. It's like, you know, it's like somehow there's a belief in one's immunity from that. I mean, how do you make that case?
Yes, you know,
how do you address that?
I think that this is actually a very, very, very big point. And to take what you're saying, what you're noticing about this ways in which some people in a more privileged place seem to be just less motivated to look at the changes that are really destroying so many people who are not in that place. I think you can even expand that out to when we look at the future and to see where things are going. And what I mean by that is, yeah, in fact, in the last chapter of my book, it's actually called Trajectories to Our Future. And I look at possible scenarios as to where all these different drivers are heading humanity. And for example, one of the possible scenarios is a true collapse of civilization. And there's another scenario which is, you know, a lot of people, especially where I'm from, here in the San Francisco Bay Area, you have the kind of Silicon Valley sort of high-tech oriented people who are looking at all the great possibilities that technological innovation can offer. And they see this, you know, potential scenario of humans, you know, even getting themselves genetically enhanced and connected with the internet through neural interfaces and all these amazing possibilities for humanity. Mm-hmm. And to your point, one of the things that you see is when they talk about the possibilities that humanity has, they're actually not really talking about humanity as 7.5 billion people in this whole world. This world in which billions of people, even today, are suffering from malnutrition and you know, have no access to even the basic fundamentals of healthcare or anything even close to that. What they're really talking about is maybe the few 100 million or so of people in the affluent world who can afford the next generation of technology and afford to do essentially whatever they want. And one of the scenarios that I view as a real potential, something we need to be more aware of, is what I call a techno split, where these huge, massive inequalities that we already see in the world economically right now could actually really become programmed into the human DNA. So within a generation or two, we might actually be looking at two different human races, where the more affluent people are so different from the rest of the human world who are dealing with the ravages of climate change that they don't even see themselves as, you know, as the same human species anymore. And that sounds like sort of some kind of science fiction scenario, whatever. But we're heading in that direction. And I honestly believe that one of the reasons why many people who live in that kind of affluent bubble, if you will, don't seem to be as concerned about the possible imminent collapse of our civilization as maybe they should be, is that, you know, I think they secretly are saying to themselves, or maybe even not so secretly among themselves, well, you know, it's going to be okay with us, for us, because, you know, as long as we sort of get keep the supply chains going and get the rare earths and the technological infrastructure going and everything else that we need to keep our society working, yeah, other people might suffer some form of collapse, but, you know, we'll be okay. And, you know, through a combination of power, exploitation, ownership of military and information resources, the affluent world will potentially be able to survive any collapse of the rest of humanity, and which is if you think of it from a moral point of view, it's a real disgrace. It's almost like a redefinition of humanity and saying, like, it's okay for us, but the rest of people can just endure their collapse, and too bad for them. I think we need to be aware of that. And personally, I'd like to see that become much more part of our public discourse when people talk about technological solutions to what's going on in the world today. Like, who are the people who are really benefiting from that?
You know, that's really interesting because, you know, for myself being, you know, reporting on a lot of the advocacy groups, grassroots communities, efforts that are going on to protect communities and the earth and, you know, the atmosphere and everything, you know, the most common meme that you always hear is, you know, don't they think of their grandchildren, or, you know, why don't you think of your grandchildren, you know, and that kind of thing. Don't you love them? I mean, this is like what you hear. And I've heard people, I think I've heard John Perkins, for example, you know, the authors speak about this, where he said, you know, they don't care about their grandchildren. And, of course, this is sort of unimaginable, but what you're pointing out is something even more specific in some ways, more understandable, which is they don't feel, you know, they feel that they'll be able to protect their grandchildren inside this bubble. I mean,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And do you think that bubble is sustainable?
Well, you know, that's a question that none of us can really know. I mean, there are, when you talk with people who really focused a lot of attention on these issues as where we're headed in the future, there is this sort of unknowable way of looking at it. For example, some people will say that our civilization is so delicate, it's almost like a house of cards, like so many things are based on so many other things, and the resources required to keep all of these different complex layers and sort of intact are actually quite tenuous. You know, for example, our society has become so, you know, tried to hone such great amount of efficiency that, you know, fuel depots maybe only have a day or two worth of fuel, and they assume they're continually going to get supplied, and supermarkets, you know, only have a day or two worth of food because they assume the supplies will stay continually. So one, And the same with factories that have been made so efficient that they are based on this continual flow. So just kind of one little shift in this system could bring, you know, within no more than a few days, hunger in big cities and massive demonstrations, and the things could come unraveling really fast. And under that scenario, if civilization collapses, everything will collapse. And people who think that they'll be able to keep their bubble together are just fantasizing. So that's one scenario. But there's this other scenario where people go, well, actually, you know, it's really it's quite grotesque to even think along these lines. But the sense is that I think people who are used to living in this affluence and they're used to this building their wealth off of exploitation, you know, they can look at things like look at things like in Central Africa, which has really had its own form of total collapse in the last few decades. But meanwhile, the rare earths still get mined there. You know, the blood diamonds still come from there. And the reason that happens is because people get so desperate that you know, when they have no choice but to essentially act, you know, as virtual slaves, just in the hope of staying alive for another month or another year or you know, whatever that time frame can be. And they are giving those resources to this whole system that ends up, you know, kind of exploiting their suffering without even thinking about it. And so the question is, you know, could that happen on a different scale, where that kind of collapse is occurring for billions of people, and the affluent minority is still, you know, living lives that they can enjoy in a more limited way? Sometimes that scenario is called Fortress Earth, because it's a sense that, you know, they basically put up their fortresses and just keep living. In fact, enjoying, you know, their virtual realities and their neural enhancements and everything else. And, you know, I think that when we look at issues like immigration right now, we see those different worldviews, those different ways of looking at humanity emerging. You know, so, of course, you know, we see it in Europe when people are coming in from Africa and the Middle East, from failed states, which have failed as a result of, ultimately, of European colonial exploitation and climate change working together to create these disasters. And then you have these differences of opinion in Europe, with some people saying, you know, we need to welcome these people and try to integrate them into our communities, and other people saying, no, you know, we should put up barriers because, you know, they're going to bring danger and they're going to take away our jobs and all the rest of it. And of course, here in the United States, with the rise of this regime in Washington and this mm-hmm. kind of way of thinking based on separations, yes. we see similar kinds of, you know, made up fears about immigration mm-hmm. and the sense of, like, you know, turn America into this fortress. And mm-hmm. so I think we see these issues already arising in our generation right now. And we're going to see much bigger divides between these two ways of thinking as we move forward. And I think it's so important, ultimately, to recognize that this arises from different definitions of what it means to be human. And you can either think of being human as being, like, you know, just looking out for yourself and your family and, you know, all the things that you can accomplish using your own ability to kind of create something in the world. Or you can think of humanity as being sort of like, I think a real inspirational document is the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, which talks about humans as a brotherhood and sisterhood, like a family of, mm-hmm. and where everyone should have a fundamental right to a life of dignity and the possibilities and a fundamental right to health care. But if you look at humanity in that way, it leads to a very different set of policy options and political choices.
Indeed. Yeah, it does. Yeah, thank you for that. I think that's, you know, something that is too little talked about as kind of the, you know, it's kind of like it really fills in the whole picture in terms of the choice points for us. You know, I have another question. Your background, you know, it is in, you know, developing a publicly traded internet company. You know, your bio here doesn't say what company it is. I don't need to know the name of the company. But I'm interested to know, from that perspective, what your view is of the internet in, you know, maybe the, like, 9 minutes remaining of the show or the 7 minutes till we have to start closing the show. I'd be very interested to know whether you think the internet is overrated as a kind of, you know, connector of people and a helpful tool, you know, to resolving some of this, or, you know, or whether you think that, you know, what its potentials might be from your perspective.
Yeah, you know, I think that actually, if anything, the internet is underrated in terms of its potential impact on our future. You know, I think if we look really big picture, from the rise of, from the emergence of humanity as a separate species, one of the most significant things that ever happened in human history was the development of language as a form of, you know, people were living in their own sort of ways of making sense of the world. And suddenly with language, there could be this shared ability to create culture together and to make meaning out of the world. And then we see, you know, the rise of writing, which was important, but not as significant as the as language itself. And then we see things like the rise of publishing, which allowed the written world to be more expanded. But I think that we may find, from the biggest perspective of history, that the rise of the internet had the potential to be pretty much as big as as transformative as language itself in terms of the ability for humans to connect up together. I think it's absolutely huge. And I do think that there is a way in which the internet has the potential to level the playing field between the power of the corporate networks and these global corporations that are devouring the world, and the power of humans at the grassroots level to connect up and fight back together. So I think that's an enormous potential of humans to use the internet to connect up together around the world and see ourselves as really kind of expand our circle of identity from being family or tribe or country to being all of humanity. And at the same time, having said all that, the threats are equally powerful. And we see the way in which right now these corporations have already turned into megaliths in our world, like Facebook, Google, Apple, Amazon, etc., where so much power has been consolidated, again, in the hands of just a few billionaires and their shareholders. And there they use the power of the internet to manipulate people and actually kind of, you know, cynically look at how they can use the dings and the thumbs up signs and all the rest of it on our smartphones to actually manipulate our hormones so that we have this kind of addictive need to check the iPhone again, you know, just within a few minutes, so we get a little bit of another kind of quick dopamine hit or whatever. So there are ways in which this power of the internet can be used to manipulate us in order to just make the billionaires even richer, or that we can work together to really redistribute the power of information around the world. So I think, and it's really huge, and it's only going to get more and more of a bigger part of this this kind of rivalry, if you will, between where the world is going to go. Are we going to go and move towards a future of this kind of split humanity, or are we going to move towards a future of a connected humanity? And I think a lot of that will play out on the internet. And that's why, you know, the issues around internet access, like sort of net neutrality, things like that, they're really super important. It's not just a technical issue. It's an issue as to how the future is going to play out for humanity as a whole.
I agree with you completely. And also, I think, you know, that we need to be more savvy in this, saying this is a popular, you know, writer and stuff. We need to be a little more savvy about how things get branded, because if I, you know, use the term net neutrality, a lot of people don't have a clue what I'm talking about. If I say, right, you know, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, people, you know, that's the official name of mad cow disease.
Right.
You know, even though I think, you know, we're talking on this show, and it's my, you know, passion and love as well, you know, to complex, interconnected systemic thinking and feeling processes and stuff, we also, we also need to be savvy about branding. And I think actually through use of the internet, people are getting more and more so. Can you, in the minutes that remain, just tell us a little bit about the Leology Institute, which is your institute, and, you know, what people can go to your website, www.leology, LIOLOGY.org in order to learn more about what you're doing, as well as making sure, and I'm going to mention the book title again, we're talking with author Jeremy Lent about The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. And it's a publication, I hardly ever mention the publisher, but I happen to love this publisher, Prometheus Books, for their willingness to kind of get out further on the branch and publish a book like this, and they do it regularly. They have a sort of more intelligent, sophisticated, you know, willingness to go to certain distances that we, you know, very much need in this time. So I just want to salute them and encourage you, listeners, to get the book and go to leology.org. So what are you doing? What are you planning to do with the Leology Institute?
Yeah, so the Leology Institute is basically a nonprofit I set up to offer a more sustainable and integrated worldview that could have the potential to give us a frame of meaning to flourish into the future as humanity. And so what does that mean exactly? Well, one of the things that I saw as I did the research for this book, The Patterning Instinct, was the ways in which we were talking about originally, the way in which that our underlying worldview itself is responsible for a lot of the destructive behavior that our society is involved in. And the word leology actually comes from a traditional Chinese word, li, which can be translated as really like the organizing principles of the way that all the different stuff of the universe connects up. So it's kind of interesting, if we, look at your at the title of your program, Connect the Dots. I mean, it's perfect because what Li really refers to is the ways in which all the different dots of the universe actually connect up. And so you can understand leology as being like the word ology, like a science of or a study of. So it's really like a study of the forms in which we are connected throughout in the universe. And the reason I chose this word, leology, is because one of the ways in which we can establish this framework of meaning is recognizing that traditional wisdom, like traditional Chinese thought, Buddhist thought, Taoist thought, indigenous thought, offers ways of making sense of the world that are very valid and powerful in today's world. But a lot of people will reject that by saying, well, you know, this is all woo-woo stuff and we need to believe in science. And so this concept of leology is actually recognizing that we can use modern systems science, rigorous analysis and findings in systems thinking to make sense of the universe in the same way that we can use traditional wisdom.
Well, we're coming to the end of our show here, but that's a wonderful note to end on. And, you know, thank you so much for being with us today, Jeremy Lent, and for all the wisdom that you're purveying and what you're doing. Get the book, The Patterning and Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning, listeners. Thank you for being with us on today's To Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. I'm Allison Rose Levy. There was me, but there was the sky.